crazy idea. It reminds me of Bohr's comment, apparently, to a lecture that Pauli was giving, where he said, after the lecture, he said, "We're all agreed that your idea is crazy. We're split, however, on whether it's crazy enough to be right." So that's probably what's going to happen in this audience as well. So it's the cosmological constant, or rather the exponential expansion of the universe, because it turns out not really to be the cosmological constant, from vacuum energy. And this is not the renormalized vacuum energy, or regularized, or anything. It's the real vacuum energy, which is huge. We recall that in 1919, Einstein introduced the cosmological constant into his field equations because he really didn't like the results that Friedman was finding, that the universe was dynamic, because everybody knew that the universe wasn't dynamic. It just sat there. So he set up his field equations in such a way that he could get a non-dynamic universe. And almost immediately, both de Sitter and, I believe, Eddington pointed out that while this was all very fine, the solution that he got was completely unstable. So you perturb it a little bit, and either the universe would exponentially expand, or it would collapse back down to zero, which wasn't really an answer to the problem that Einstein was trying to solve. And of course, also Hubble demonstrated that the universe really was dynamic. So Einstein always called this his greatest blunder, or his biggest mistake, that if only he had taken it seriously, he would have had another great prediction 10 years before the measurements actually demonstrated what was happening. So the cosmological constant was basically zero. Get rid of it until, in the 1980s, people started arguing that the evidence seemed to be that the universe was not just sort of growing and collapsing a la the Friedman, Robertson, Walker kinds of solutions, but it really did seem to have an exponential expansion in it. Exactly what causes that is unclear. People argued, for example, that if you look at the quantum field theory and you look at the vacuum of quantum field theory, you argue, well, look, the vacuum state is Lorentz invariant. Is going to be homogeneous. So whatever this thing does is supposed to be homogeneous, and it should also be homogeneous in space and time. The only thing you can think of is the cosmological constant. Unfortunately, of course, if you look at the vacuum state of quantum fields, although they're almost, you know, certainly non-zero, they're much closer to infinity than they are to 10 to the 10th, a time scale of 10 to the 10th years, which is what people were arguing about whether or not it existed. Let's take bosonic fields. Each of the modes in a bosonic field basically has 1/2 h bar omega of energy in it. And if you add these guys all up, and you go, let's say, to around the Planck scale, you find that there's a Planck scale's worth of energy density. And if that were really the cosmological constant, then the whole universe would be dynamic on the time scale of Planck time, which is a little bit short, 10 to the minus 44 seconds or less. And that's sort of not what we see around us. So one has to try and solve this problem, and we've now spent something like 50 years trying to solve this problem and not really getting terribly far. One of the things about these arguments is that they really neglect the fluctuations in this vacuum energy density. You say, wait a minute, what about fluctuations? I mean, it's the vacuum state is homogeneous and so forth. Where are the fluctuations? Well, if you take the stress energy tensor and you look at it or average it out over a small region of space-time, that doesn't commute with the total energy. The total energy, the vacuum state is the lowest energy eigenstate of the total energy. These guys don't commute. So in the vacuum state, if you make measurements of the local energy density, you're going to find fluctuating values. And in fact, if you stick it in and you ask what is the, you know, standard deviation of those fluctuations, you find that they're as big as this non-renormalized energy momentum tensor is. So you have really humongous fluctuations. If you take those seriously, that would suggest that the universe is doing really weird things from one, let's say, Planck scale to the next. It's doing, must be doing all kinds of really strange things, because if you imagine the gravitational field as measuring the energy momentum tensor, then it's measuring these wildly fluctuating values from one place to the next. So why don't we try and take these energy densities and these fluctuating energy densities seriously? Well, back a number of years ago, I got a student coming in from China, and I got him thinking about the problem of, in his master's thesis, about this energy, this non-renormalized energy density, and in particular, the problem that we decided to look at was the following. Let's imagine that we've got a little particle, and to make the calculation simple, all of these were being done in 1+1 dimensions. There was one spatial dimension and one temporal dimension. And this particle interacts with a scalar field. In one dimension, 1+1 dimensions, about all you have are scalar fields anyway. So we'll just take a simple massless scalar field where one can actually do the calculations and imagine this particle is interacting. Now, of course, you get divergences. However, one can imagine that somehow or other this particle interacts with the field in such a way that there's a natural cutoff. In particular, what we did was we said, okay, let's assume that this little particle has an internal degree of freedom, which is just a simple harmonic oscillator degree of freedom. That simple harmonic oscillator degree of freedom interacts with the scalar field and can get excited. Well, this is a nice linear problem, and you can actually solve it, which is always nice. At low frequencies, one discovers that this particle basically reflects all of the radiation that impinges on it. And at high frequencies, it becomes transparent. Let's, in fact, take this harmonic oscillator on the inside to have zero frequency, so that that internal degree of freedom is simply a free particle. That makes the whole calculation even simpler. And you get that at low frequencies, depending on the coupling constant between the scalar field and this internal harmonic oscillator, at low frequencies, you get this thing acts like a perfect mirror and reflects all of the radiation. At high frequencies, it transmits all of the radiation. So this suggests that this kind of a system has, in some sense, a natural cutoff for the interaction with the radiation that's impinging on it. Now, this radiation coming in hits this little particle, hits the mirror, bounces off, and therefore produces a force. And the radiation coming in from the two directions, each of them produce a force on the particle, And you say, well, wait a minute, this is just completely symmetric, so those forces cancel out. Well, on average, yes, they certainly do cancel out. So on average, the force coming this way is exactly the same as the force coming that way. But of course, the particle doesn't care about averages. Well, it does, but we'll get to that. It's going to react to the instantaneous force. And the instantaneous force, or the instantaneous momentum in the stress energy tensor, doesn't commute with the total energy, and therefore it fluctuates like mad. Now, one could imagine doing full quantum mechanics of this system, but let's do an easier problem, and that is sort of stochastic quantum mechanics, where you say, okay, this radiation field provides a force, and that acts like a sort of classical, highly fluctuating stochastic force on this particle. One of the things that you discover about the stochastic force, if you look at it carefully, is that it's anti-correlated. In other words, if you look at the radiation coming in from one side and the pressure it exerts on that mirror, you get this humongous pressure given by basically the cutoff scale at one instant, and at the next instant, you get a negative pressure or a pull on that particle from the fluctuations. It's actually still a pressure, but it's much less than the average pressure. The average pressures cancel out. The particle, of course, responds to these humongous forces acting on it by starting to move. But an instant later, the force is acting in the opposite direction from the average. And the particle sits there, basically integrating out, just from F equals ma, over these equations of motion. And if one goes through the calculation, one finds that, yes, this particle has these huge forces, but if we just look at the position of the particle and ask what happens to the position of the particle, one finds that the position wiggles around, but it just wiggles around a tiny little bit. Its velocity is of the order of c, but its displacement is bounded. Because of this anti-correlation in the pressures, you don't get a Brownian motion. You don't get a random walk. A random walk, we know that the displacement increases as the square root of the time. Here, the displacement simply goes up to a constant value and then sits there. This particular model, the model in which we use a dot coupling, a velocity coupling, which is a really nice model because this gives ohmic coupling to the harmonic oscillator. If you look at the equation of motion of the harmonic oscillator, you find that the harmonic, it's not a harmonic oscillator, it's a set, it's a free particle. You find it's a damped free particle with the with an external force given by field, the impinging field acting on it. One of the problems with this thing is that harmonic oscillator, if one asks what is the energy, one finds that energy grows as the cutoff, goes as logarithm of the cutoff. So the particle, in a sense, gets more massive, and it turns out that for this coupling, that extra mass that the particle picks up because of this huge internal energy of this internal degree of freedom turns out to be crucial to make sure that the particle doesn't move very much. But it all comes together consistently, and one gets what looks very, very much like those old ideas from the 19 quantum mechanics, where people talked about the Zeta-Bewegung of the little electrons, where the velocity was roughly c, but the amplitude was nice and bounded. Can we do a bit better than this? I'm restating here. We can do a little bit better than this by putting in a non-derivative coupling. In other words, instead of having q dot in there, one just has phi times q. This, however, is problematic because it turns out to be unstable. Infrared unstable, if you will. The classical theory has got exponentially growing modes down very near zero frequencies, slowly exponentially growing modes. You can get rid of them by putting in a small mass. That mass is large enough, and that depends on the cutoff, that depends on the coupling strength between the field and the harmonic oscillator. Then you can get rid of that instability. It, of course, makes the analysis messier. But it turns out you can still do the analysis. Now at high frequencies, the q dot brings in an omega into the coupling, which means at high frequencies, the coupling doesn't disappear. For this kind of a coupling at high frequencies, the coupling basically drops off as 1 over omega squared. And you get a finite value for the total energy of the particle. There's no divergence, even with cutoff. So one can even take the cutoff of the theory off to infinity. So this was sort of nice. It says maybe we can take seriously these huge energy densities, or in this case, pressures, of the quantum field and get something that looks like semi-sensible results. Well, Chindi then went off and said, okay, why don't I try this in some other areas? And his idea was perhaps we could use this somehow or other in the cosmological constant problem. And I said, come on, this is ridiculous. The nice thing about the problem that we had was that the forces cancel. The forces from the field coming in the two sides cancel. So you get no large average force acting on here. In the case of the expansion of the universe, the energy in the field doesn't cancel with some other energy. It's just big and huge. How in the world could that ever work? And he was stubborn. And I kept trying to get him to do something else and said, you probably aren't going to be able to get a thesis if you keep going this track. And he kept going on that track. And as sometimes happens, he was probably more right than I am. And finally, the results that he got were sufficiently beguiling. I felt it was worth putting them out there for people to look at. Now, what we have is not a fully worked out scenario. We do not have the solution to the exponential expansion of the universe with no problems and all the I's and I's crossed and T's dotted or whatever. But let's take these fluctuations seriously. You've got a highly inhomogeneous stress energy tensor now. The value here is more or less uncorrelated with the value here, a short distance away. So the universe has got all of this really huge energy in it fluctuating back and forth. In many ways, this looks very much like Wheeler's space-time foam ideas from the 1970s, where he sort of made these very hand-wavy arguments that somehow, if you look at quantum gravity on a very short scale, the metric should be fluctuating like mad from one point to the next. It shouldn't be all nice and smooth. The problem, of course, is that even if we do the stochastic idea, we have this horribly inhomogeneous universe, so we've got to solve all of these equations, Einstein's equations, and that's no more solvable than full quantum gravity is. It's a mess. So what can we do? Well, as always with physicists, you simplify the hell out of the problem until you get something that maybe you can say something about. So let's simplify the hell out of this. Let's assume that the metric only has a scale factor. So we have, you know, dt squared. This is obviously picking out a preferred time. Minus the scale factor times, you know, dx squared plus dy squared plus dz squared. And this A is going to be the only gravitational degree of freedom that we're going to hang on to and hope to be able to solve. Whoops.
Bill, I mean, you know that A is not really a gravitational degree of freedom, right?
Sorry?
You know, A is not really a gravitational degree of freedom because...
It is certainly a metric degree of freedom. And metric degrees of freedom I call gravitational degrees of freedom. So just to be clear in nomenclature, I agree that A is largely determined by, you know, sort of tied to the other things, but...
usually you have constraint equations and dynamical equations, and A usually is determined by the...
Fine. But we're calling it... constraint equations, you can constrain anything you want. Some people like constraining the conformal factors. Some people like constraining other things. That's completely up to you in full Einstein gravity. So you can say any degree of freedom of the gravitational field is the constrained guy.
But at the linearized level, the constraint...
Linearized? Who's doing linearized?
So you're saying you don't do linearized?
I'm not doing linearized. This is, as you're going to see, is completely not linearized. However, we are going to make huge... approximations. We can't solve all of Einstein's equations, even in this case. In fact, all of Einstein's equations are almost certainly in conflict with each other. If I have only this one degree of freedom in the metric field, then all 10 of Einstein's equations equal to some source, which is due to some scalar field, just aren't going to be consistent altogether, unless one were to pick some very special solution. But especially in these highly inhomogeneous cases that we're looking at, you know, in the homogeneous case, we know that A on its own, yeah, you can solve all of the equations, because almost all the equations are trivial. They're already solved for you. This isn't true here. So what we do is we use the lamppost principle, you know, the old one. A guy walking down the street at night comes across somebody on his hands and knees searching on the ground. He says, what's the matter? I lost my contact lenses. Oh, can I help you? Sure. Crawls around a while. Are you sure this is where you lost them? No. Well, why are you looking here? Because there's a light. So we're going to do the same thing. We're going to take the simplest of these equations and solve them. And in particular, if we take a combination of Einstein's equations, this combination here, then what we find is that the equation for the scale factor, one of the equations that we get from one of Einstein's equations for the scale factor, is just A double dot plus omega squared A equals zero. So of course, A double dot divided by A is the Einstein one, plus omega squared, where omega squared is given by the energy and the pressure of the scalar field. Well, this is just a harmonic oscillator. It's, of course, a harmonic oscillator where the frequency is the stochastic variable. It's huge, and from one instant of time to the next, it changes. It's always positive for the scalar field. Mode by mode, this guy is positive. But it has an average value, which goes as the cutoff, and we're going to need a cutoff in this theory, which goes as the cutoff to the fourth power. And it has fluctuations, which are of that same order of magnitude. So the standard deviation is also of that same order of magnitude. So we've got a highly stochastic harmonic oscillator here, which whose frequency drives the harmonic oscillator.
So Bill, I think I'm not sure if you mentioned it's a massless scalar field. This is only true for
massless scalar field.
As for massive, it could change sign.
We're working in the regime in which, you know, we are way, 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 way above any masses, so everything looks like a massless scalar field. I keep messing this up. Yeah, okay. So let's assume that we've got a theory. This theory has a cutoff, and this cutoff is significantly above the Planck scale. For a single scalar field, it turns out we're going to need something like 1,000 times the Planck scale in order to get the answer we want. That means that omega is going to go as that cutoff. Omega, which is the square root of omega squared, is going to go as lambda squared. So it's going to be much larger than the cutoff scale. So we've got the scalar field running around, and that scalar field, we're going to assume, more or less has the same stress energy tensor as it would have in flat spacetime. And it's going to be true because for these fields, they've got such a long wavelength that they're going to just average out over a squared. Why a squared? Well, it's a squared that comes into the metric. They're just going to average out over all of those vastly fluctuating a squared terms to give a constant value. Of course, a is going to fluctuate like mad. It's going to have these sinusoidal fluctuations on a time scale of 1 over lambda squared. Incredibly rapid fluctuations going through zero. But of course, that equation of motion doesn't care if A goes through zero. It's still a perfectly valid equation of motion. Harmonic oscillator doesn't care if A, or if the argument is sometimes equal to zero. So the scalar field is simply going to average out over these fluctuations and see basically a metric with a constant a squared. And so therefore, we can regard this metric as sitting in a flat spacetime with some average a squared stuck in there. Well, if that were the end of the story, we wouldn't have gotten anywhere. However, the scalar field, the energy momentum tensor of the scalar field itself fluctuates. And as we know, if we have a harmonic oscillator with a fluctuating frequency, you get things like parametric resonance. You know, the old story of a kid standing on a swing, and if he moves up and down at just the right rate, the swing starts doing this and exponentially grows in amplitude. Well, here these fluctuations are much, much lower frequency. The cutoff scale and the fluctuation scale is of the order of lambda, whereas the fluctuations in A of the spring are of order lambda squared. But that equation is a nonlinear reaction of A to the frequency. And so you get harmonics coming in. The higher harmonics of this fluctuating force can get into the resonance band and begin to amplify these oscillations of A. And that's the idea. We notice that the modes of the scalar field, as I said, just average out over stuff. And we have loads of examples of that. If one thinks of sound waves in this room, and you look at the density of the air inside this room, you realize that that density goes from, you know, something like 10 to the 20th grams per cubic centimeter at the location of the nuclei to zero between the atoms. So you've got a monstrously fluctuating density field. Does that matter as far as the sound waves are concerned? No, they just average out. Because they have such long wavelength, they simply average out over all of these density fluctuations and propagate as though there were some nice standard average density. Similarly, these waves simply propagate as though there was this nice average of A squared that they're propagating through. Omega squared is, of course, not strictly periodic. But if you look at the correlation function of omega squared at one point versus omega squared at another point, you see that it actually does oscillate at roughly the cutoff scale. So you're getting this sort of oscillating driving force. The frequency of that oscillation is extremely low, but that driving force is driving the harmonic oscillator, which is A, and you get parametric resonance. Very, very weak parametric resonance.
Would it be still time diff invariant if you...
Pardon?
Because it looks like to me you effectively this frequency changed A, but if you do it like time shift or something, would it still keep A?
Well, remember, these oscillations are very, very long wavelength compared to the fluctuations of A. The fluctuations of A are going as A squared, as lambda squared, square root of lambda to the fourth. And these fluctuations are of the order of lambda. And if lambda is much larger than the Planck scale, this is just this very slow fluctuation. Yes?
Doesn't your A go through zero?
A goes to, well, this is not A, this is the fluctuation, but yes, A does go to zero.
So that means your volume, space-time.
But remember, it's only going to zero here, and it's not zero here.
If it's still you.
So this tiny little bit of space-time collapses, but this space-time right beside it hasn't.
But the space-time is getting into trouble.
Yes, and we'll get to that. We'll get to that.
You can't have the volume.
Well, that's one of the questions.
Also, I have another question. Back to your field equations. If you set the fluctuations to zero, you should get back Einstein.
One of Einstein's equations. No, you don't get it. You get zero. You get, if there's no driving force, if T mu nu is zero, then the Einstein's equations give you, our G mu nu's are all equal to zero.
Space.
What?
They then give you to sit in space.
No. Yep. I have no bare cosmological constant here.
So lambda G mu nu is zero.
Lambda G mu nu is zero, yes. So everything is coming from, you know, I'm taking Einstein seriously post 1919, 1920, whatever, 1926, lambda is equal to zero. I've always liked that much better anyway. But.
I'm concerned about the fact that you don't solve Einstein's equations.
What?
You don't seem to solve Einstein's field equations.
I'm not solving all of Einstein's equations, no. I'm solving one of them, because that's all I know how to do. That's this lamppost principle. I'm looking for the solution in places where I might be able to see the solution.
One last thing. You assume superposition linearly. Linear
solutions for A. Well, A is a linear equation.
Yeah, but the gravity is non-linear.
The driving force is this hugely fluctuating stuff, but the equation of motion for A in this case is a linear equation.
That's a strong assumption.
It's one of Einstein's equations, as I said. And of course, linear equations are far easier to solve than nonlinear ones. So one carefully chooses which equations one tries to solve. And I'll get to that again. So because of the fluctuations in the frequency, these very low frequency fluctuations in the, I'm reusing frequency in two different ways. Because of the fluctuations in the frequency of the harmonic oscillator, which is A, one gets this very weak parametric resonance. And people have looked at this kind of a situation. And what they found was that if the frequency of omega squared is very small, you get an exponential expansion, a parametric resonance, which produces an exponential expansion, which basically goes as lambda e to the minus something or other times lambda as the scale of this exponential growth. So what are these, what is this stuff seeing? Well, it can't see these horrendously rapid fluctuations in A because they're far too high a frequency. It's just, you know, like the sound waves in this room, it just averages out over them. But the amplitude of those fluctuations gradually increases. So what the scalar field sees is a universe that seems to slowly be getting bigger. On a time scale that looks like this. If I choose lambda properly, so let's say for one field, I get a value that's something of the order of 10 to the 10th years if I choose lambda to be roughly something like 1,000. So we're operating, you know, at 1,000 Planck scales. Well, who says Planck scale exactly is exactly where things happen? If I choose that cutoff, then I get this very, 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 very slow expansion of A squared gradually increases. And it looks to the scalar field and so forth and to us as though the size of the universe was very slowly increasing.
Sorry, you might have said that. So what's beta?
What?
What's beta?
Beta is just some constant that depends on the details. It's of the order of one.
Why is that? Is it positive or negative? What determines
positive.
What determines the sign of that constant?
The negative stuff, the decaying, disappears. I mean, as usual, the decaying mode disappears immediately, and it's only the expanding mode that is going to have any effect. So this is the basic idea. One can get a very gradual exponential expansion of the universe, even if one takes the stress energy, the unrenormalized, unregularized stress energy tensor seriously. Here are some computer simulations that Zhao did, in which we, you know, took the equations, took in a fluctuating scalar field, you know, randomly chose the phases of the scalar field, and looked at the what the value of the average value of a squared would look like, and what one, and this is on a log plot, and you notice that we get this steady increase. If we increase the cutoff, that slope decreases. So the higher the cutoff, the smaller the slope. So one could say, well, let's take everything seriously. That cutoff should be infinite. Then you get a zero cosmological constant. And that would solve the old cosmological constant problem, right? Why is the cosmological constant not zero? And the answer is, it's because there's no cutoff in the quantum field theory that drives the scale factor of the universe. So here's a plot of these slopes as a function of lambda. And that slope is basically the value of beta. And so in this particular case, the slope was 0.12. So beta was basically 0.12. And that depends on the exact details, how many scalar fields one has. All of this kind of stuff determines beta, but it's all something of the order of one. Notice that the cutoff plays a crucial role. What provides that cutoff? No idea. Is there some dynamics to that cutoff? No idea.
And you're trusting Einstein gravity, I guess, on scales that are much bigger. I guess no, you're trusting Einstein gravity on a scale that are much bigger than Planck scale.
Right. Well, I mean, if 1,000 is a big number, then much bigger, yes. I mean, depending on whom you talk to, 1,000 can be very small. You know, it's almost of order one.
I'm still a bit puzzled. You say you have a cosmological constant.
So we don't have a cosmological constant. We've got an exponential expansion of the universe.
But you have a lambda.
No. Sorry, I do have a lambda, and that lambda is absolutely huge.
So when you put the fluctuation...
Sorry, I think we're getting confused. Lambda that we're talking about there is the cutoff scale. It's not the cosmological constant. That cutoff scale, so the expectation value of the stress energy tensor is of the order of lambda to the fourth.
As usual.
Okay. So there's, if you will, a bare cosmological constant. Well, I can never figure out which power of lambda corresponds to the energy density. But anyway, but you have a huge cosmological, average cosmological constant. And that drives the scale factor to oscillate at this horrendously fast scale, okay?
So if you put the fluctuation to zero, you should get Einstein gravity with this huge cosmological constant.
Yes.
But then you probably won't solve the field equations.
These fluctuations are absolutely crucial to the argument. If you want to solve a different theory, then of course I'm going to get different answers. Well, is this the solution? Well, there are all kinds of open questions. First thing, as I said, I just solved one of Einstein's equations. Well, Chindi solved one of Einstein's equations, not 10 of them. Can this be extended to the full metric? Now, this is tough, because this is a highly inhomogeneous source that's driving the Einstein equations. So one has to solve Einstein's equations in a highly inhomogeneous setting, and that's not easy. Do those neglected Einstein equations destroy the effect? We have A going to zero. Do the nonlinearities in the other Einstein equations mean that those things really become singularities and A can't go through zero? You know, which completely stop A going through zero. I don't know.
You don't want A going through zero.
What?
You don't want A going through zero. The volume goes to zero.
The volume at a little, this tiny little volume goes to zero. The volume here is still non-zero, but lambda, 1 over lambda to the fourth Planck times later, that little volume will go to zero, and this one will be non-zero, etc. Of course we should be solving Einstein's the full quantum theory of gravity, of course. Please give it to me and tell me how to solve it.
Well,
I mean, at that point you stop. I mean, you just say, I can't do it. And then you quit.
There's something in between those two options, which is to solve the Schrodinger equation with the effect of Hamiltonian that you're using to do your classical dynamics.
I can't solve the Schrodinger equation. I can't solve the Wheeler-DeWitt equation, the infinite number of degrees of freedom in the Wheeler-DeWitt equation, any more than I can solve.
I just mean you have this effective classical system.
But sorry?
You have this effective classical system that you're solving. And there is a corresponding quantum system. There is just the Schrodinger equation. There's solving the quantum mechanical system. Let's accept all of the simplifications you're making. It just seems like the one that doesn't look like it's justified is continuing to solve the classical equations of motion.
That may be true. That may be true.
And then you might not have to worry about
that. And it would be really nice to be able to even do that. But remember that this equation that we're solving is a harmonic oscillator with a horribly fluctuating frequency. You know, it's fluctuating on all kinds of timescales. And at that point, solving that quantum system becomes really hard as well. You know, if it were constant, of course, then we all know how to solve it. We learned that in our first year of quantum mechanics. But if omega is fluctuating like mad, then that becomes a lot more difficult to solve.
That degree of freedom could also be treated in quantum mechanics.
It's not a single degree of freedom. It's all the basically microscopic degrees of freedom in the scalar field. So basically, it's like a Brownian motion that you have all these degrees of freedom in the scalar that's back reactive of the metric.
Where does this cutoff come from? We're just sticking it in by hand. Is there some dynamics that gives this cutoff? As in the little model of the particle being bombarded by quantum fields from the two directions, there the cutoff came because of the coupling between that internal degrees of freedom of that particle and the external field. Is there some way in which one can make a similar kind of story here? We don't know.
Well, Mark, about the...
Do gravity... Oh, sorry.
About the neglected degrees of freedom in Einstein's equations. I think if there is anisotropy...
If there is...
Anisotropy,
right.
Which of course is neglected in your case.
No, we haven't neglected it.
Well...
There's huge anisotropy.
Somewhere you neglect it, because anisotropy... In the Friedmann equations, or as well as in the A double dot equation, anisotropy is the term that dominates over everything else. So you have
in some of the equations, that's true. Not in the equation that we're looking at.
I think including in the equation
no.
You're looking at. I think anisotropy is the dominant term as long as there is any little amount of it, still is the dominant term when A goes to zero. So I believe you have neglected something which
of course.
Is very important.
I mean, as I said, we've neglected
the equation completely. That
may be true, okay? There's all, as I said, we've neglected a whole bunch of Einstein's equations, including Einstein's equations that link what's going on at one point to the other, derivatives with respect to x in Einstein equation. We've neglected those equations. And those equations, I mean, one shouldn't be neglecting any of Einstein's equations.
Right.
Okay. So this is that first point, the first point, yeah, I mean.
No, but it's about the issue of A going to zero. You have neglected a very important term.
Agreed.
Change completely your
equation. Agreed. That's fine. I mean, you can vote with Bohr at the end. Now, one of the things, remember that in this case, I said A was oscillating like mad on scales of lambda squared. Whereas the matter fields had a cutoff of order lambda, and lambda is bigger than one. So in that sense, the gravitational degrees of freedom, or at least of the scale factor, don't have the same cutoff as the matter fields do. Which cutoff do gravity waves have? Gravity waves are certainly parts of the metric, and this would seem to say that those parts of the metric shouldn't have a cutoff, and yet that's going to mess, because the gravity waves also contribute to the stress energy tensor, the effect of stress energy tensor, which is going to drive the scale factor or whatever. I don't know. An even worse problem is fermions. Bosons have 1/2 h bar omega of energy in every mode. Fermions have minus 1/2 h bar omega of energy in every mode. So fermions fluctuate around a negative value. Now, if we allow omega squared to become negative, then A, instead of oscillating, exponentially grows or dies, and on time scales of order 1 over lambda squared, over a time period of the order of lambda, so that's a huge exponential growth, and that would just completely and utterly destroy this whole model.
And the universe.
Well, the universe does what it does, okay? But the universe in this model would really have problems, I agree. So never mind A going to zero, A getting extremely large from one point to the next would be a disaster as well. As has been stated, this is all on the stochastic gravity framework. One is replacing this quantum argument, you know, the stress energy tensor at around a point is doesn't commute with the vacuum, and therefore you get large fluctuations, and we're imagining those large fluctuations are really like classical fluctuations and doing the calculation on that basis. That's clearly some sort of approximation to what's actually happening in the quantum regime. So one should be solving these equations quantum mechanically. I agree perfectly. We chose a special time. Well, although everybody, you know, string theorists keep playing around with time being special and all of that as well these days, I, as a relativist, really don't like this very much. Is there some way in which we can make this more invariant upon the choice of the time? Note that this metric is not conformally invariant. That A of x, I can't pull out as a conformal factor. If A were a function only of t, then you could always pull it out as a conformal factor. But this A is a function of both t and x, and I can't get a conformal factor out of it. So it's not, and time here has got a special role. A goes through zero, That's no problem for the equations we used, but there are other equations which are much more complicated and nonlinear than the one that we used. Does that destroy everything? One of the problems, of course, is what about the low-energy Einstein equations, the stuff way down underneath the Planck scale? We've just had these wonderful gravity wave experiments which have shown that Einstein gravity really works extremely well on scales of kilometers or longer. Does this stuff, due to the nonlinearity of the gravitational wave equations, feed down into the low-energy theory and destroy the low-energy theory? Well, it obviously feeds down in some sense because it produces this exponential, very slow exponential expansion of the universe, but that's okay. I mean, a very slow exponential expansion is not going to destroy the gravity wave experiments. It's going to be nice. But it's not at all clear that these rapid fluctuations don't have other effects on scales that might destroy the Einstein might destroy the gravity wave results, and that would be a disaster. Or even the Newtonian limit, planetary motion. Can one extend this argument to inflation? After all, inflation is supposed to be a time of exponential expansion. We've got exponential expansion here. Can one unify them? Well, that would require that the coupling, that the cutoff scale was small, was near the Planck scale, so that that parametric excitation had a very short time scale, and then suddenly became very long later on in the age of the universe. Well, that sounds pretty hokey to me. Or is inflation just sort of part of the low energy theory? If one could show that this high energy stuff, this rapid oscillation stuff, had no effect on the long wavelength Einstein equations, then, you know, it wouldn't have an effect even on inflation, even though the inflation timescale is much shorter than 10 to the 10th years. We would just drive inflation with, you know, a scalar field or whatever, a slow roll, etc., that one has always done in the past. So this wouldn't change anything as far as inflation is concerned. So there are loads of open questions. I like to say there are loads of opportunities here. Of course, many of you might say there are loads of ways of saying that this whole thing is crap. And I can't really argue against you that strongly, except that one is getting an exponential growth to the universe on very slow timescales via a mechanism that is completely different than something anybody else has ever looked at. It may turn out to be complete crap, but we've been battling our heads against this problem of the cosmological constant now for 50 or 80 years and really getting nowhere. I mean, every single new generation comes up with exactly the same arguments before and the same counter arguments as before. Maybe there's something here. Maybe this little piece of swamp, which looks like a complete and utter swamp, as I told Chindi, has some little path through it which might give us a new way of looking at the exponential expansion of the universe. That's it. Yes.
No cosmological constant problem for a massless field. And
sorry,
it's pretty well established. You cannot get a cosmological constant from a massless scalar field or massless field for general.
From
a massless field.
Massless?
So I mean I think you're just reproducing that.
You cannot get a uniform spatially homogeneous perhaps.
No, because basically if you take a massless field, try to do these integrals that are UV divergent, you get something that has the equation of a state of radiation.
That is what?
Has the equation of a state of radiation. Because basically, if massless particles, the energy momentum tensor is just
photons.
Yeah.
Like photons, right, exactly.
Photons symmetry.
Well, that's exactly what, I mean, we got these little bouncing universes, right? The universe expands and recollapses.
I think it was well established that for massless particles, because of conformal symmetry.
This does not have negative pressures, I agree.
Okay, so I think this is not the cosmological constant problem.
No. I said at the beginning, I shouldn't call it cosmological constant, it's the exponential expansion of the universe. But virtually everybody in the community talks about the exponential.
You're saying, maybe this process solves all cosmological constant problems. And I'm saying, you're not solving.
By the cosmological constant problem here, I mean that the universe appears to be exponentially expanding.
No, but that's okay.
I mean, that sentence says that you're providing.
The universe seems to be exponentially expanding. Virtually everybody calls that the cosmological constant.
It's the Sitter space.
The Sitter space, whatever.
Not the cosmological constant problem. That's an older
no.
problem. But it's a problem with massive fields, not massless.
No, this is massless fields as well.
No, massless fields, there is no cosmological constant for massless. I mean, you may call it, but it's not. It's just you can calculate it.
Fine, if you don't want to call it a cosmological constant problem, I don't care. Exponential expansion of the universe. Replace everywhere where I say cosmological constant by exponential expansion of the universe.
No, I think you're missing words.
No, this is what I mean. What I'm doing is saying, look, the evidence is that we have an exponential expansion of the universe.
That's
we don't understand why.
That's the evidence.
That's the, you know.
That's not the problem. So
the problem is we can't explain it.
But the problem is that the calculation gives you a large number.
Yes.
But it's only for massive fields.
I don't care for what. You get a large number.
But only for massive fields, you get zero.
No, you don't. You have to renormalize it. You get this very, very large energy density.
Well, that's my point. You get zero. So if you normalize
it. No, you renormalize. But we're not renormalizing it. I'm saying take the energy density seriously. Don't renormalize.
But if you don't renormalize it, you're violating diffeomorphism invariance, for example.
I mean, you're violating?
Diffeomorphism invariance. You don't even have consistent equations to solve if you don't renormalize it.
Fine. I mean, if that's.
Yeah, but that's the point I'm making. That
if you don't want to even think about this, that's certainly you're right.
I'm saying it's not a well-defined calculation. If you don't know.
It's a very well. The calculations we did are very well defined. They're incomplete. I agree.
You just solved.
But I can't look. In your calculations, you assume that everything is homogeneous. It's not.
No, that's not my calculation. But I'm saying that's. And the question, are there even consistent equations in the premise?
In this, if you...
We're never solving them.
If you assume that the space is homogeneous and that all terms are homogeneous, then the equations can all be solved, primarily because all of them are equal to zero except for two of them, and one of them being the integral of the other. They're automatically solved, and so, of course, you can solve them. But we're making the assumption here, we're trying to attack a much harder problem, namely, the stress energy tensor is not homogeneous. It's horribly inhomogeneous. What are the effects of that horrible inhomogeneity on the behavior of the universe?
Well, we all love the standard model, lambda CDU, because of six parameters.
Yes.
You seem to fit everything amazingly well.
Right.
I don't see how you're ever going to get that from here. It's homogeneous, the standard model, and isotropic.
Right. Well, on average, on the scales that we look at around us, or on the scales of cosmological scales, this is homogeneous. Because you average over these horrible fluctuations, and they just average out to be a constant. However, if you look in detail at the way in which the universe is behaving on Planck scales or sub-Planck scales, it's oscillating like mad. It's horribly inhomogeneous from one point to the next. But those inhomogeneities just average out to give you something that looks very homogeneous.
But then your average result should be the Einstein field equations, homogeneous isotropic space-time.
Well,
they won't be.
All I'm saying is that the average Einstein equations that we get here give you an exponential expansion of the universe. One can argue that, look, the other Einstein field equations, we can sort of split up into low-frequency stuff and high-frequency stuff. The high-frequency stuff simply averages out, okay, as far as the low-frequency stuff is concerned. So that the effective equations of motion for the universe on long scales are, one hopes, Einstein's equations. Still Einstein's equations.
One hopes.
One hopes. Certainly haven't shown this.
The other thing is that you seem to be using semi-classical gravity.
Stochastic gravity. Stochastic gravity is what it's called. It's not semi-classical gravity, it's stochastic gravity. Because one is taking into account the fluctuations caused by quantum.
Space-time is not quantized.
Well, nothing is quantized.
Well, you're using quantum matter.
You're using quantum matter, but only in the sense that that provides a classical stochastic field which derives the Einstein equations.
Doesn't that break down for large, huge fluctuations? Semi-classical gravity breaks down for large fluctuations.
This isn't semi-classical gravity. This is stochastic gravity, where one is trying to take into account those kinds of fluctuations in a classical kind of theory.
So since we've had a lot of questions and we're a little bit over, why don't we save more questions for lunch or later?
Sorry?
Why don't we save more questions for lunch or afterwards?
For lunchtime?
A little bit over.
Sure.
Yeah, let's thank Bill again.
So.